Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest edition of AppForCast. Today is June 4th, and this is your host, John Gossier. So you may notice that the sounds just slightly different this episode. A couple of weeks ago, my MacBook died. That's normally what I use to record the show on. I've since been using my iMac, but I use a Skype headset to record because it's USB and there's no line level interference. Anyway, long story short, I had to get a new computer to replace the MacBook. It's a PC. It's Vista. Won't go there, but so I'm using this open source multi-track audio recording tool called Audacity, and a different Skype headset that does use a line input. So you know, it sounds a little bit different. You can let me know if it's better or worse or unbearably bad, but you know, I'm working with what I have here. So before we get into the show, I want to make a couple of big announcements. If you've been following the blog, or if you know me personally or follow like my Twitter or anything like that, you've probably caught the news that I've had the honor of being nominated and accepted to be a TED Fellow. TED is this big conference that occurs now, I think, two or three times a year. Originally, it was once a year in Long Beach, California, but they've sort of scaled up a bit, and they're moving it around to different parts of the globe each year. It's known most for these sort of really inspirational talks that different thought leaders from various sectors give at the conference. You know, these videos have sort of virally spread around the web. You know, you can hear Stephen Hawking talk about, you know, the creation of the universe, or Jacqueline Novogratz talk about the creation of Acumen Fund, or, you know, Al Gore talking about global warming. And it's just really inspirational, thought-provoking ideas. In fact, the overall theme of TED, the overall brand of TED, is ideas worth sharing, which they certainly do drive home with the people that they select and the people that present there. So it's quite an honor. I feel way out of my league just reading the description of some of my fellows. It's you know people with PhDs doing dynamic visualization of astrophysics using medical software, or there's a guy who's doing actually a Ugandan guy who is doing a lot of work in biotechnology, and, you know, quite a few other people. Definitely an interesting lot. I will learn a lot, and I hope that, you know, I live up to the honor, but it's really exciting. It's one of the most exciting things I've ever done. So thanks for everyone who supported me and wished me congratulations afterwards. Really appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to it. So if you'd like to follow that, the actual conference starts July 21st and ends on July 24th. The other news is, the other news I can't quite share just yet, but it's really exciting and sort of jaw-dropping for me, but it's big. That's all I can say right now for the benefit of all parties involved, but it's really big. I'll get into the show. Natalie's not here today. She is, we're recording this show a little bit late. What's today? Today's Thursday. We're supposed to record every Monday, but I was really busy this week. She was really busy this week, and we had a conference on Tuesday Wednesday was a holiday, and now here it is, almost the end of the week, and we haven't done the show yet. So on Tuesday, Natalie and I attended a think tank put on by the UCC, which is the Uganda Communications Commission. They're the regulator of the communications industry in Uganda. And the event was all about consumer rights, consumer protection, and advocacy in relation to, in particularly, mobile operators, but just technology in general. There's been sort of a big movement here to... I mentioned a few episodes ago that my lawyer Paul Asimwe and some other people like James Wiere were forming somewhat of a coalition to advocate for consumer rights to become a recognized party. The Ugandan government actually is recognizing and responding to some of these requests for dialogue. So they formed this UCC body, which is mandated with just dealing with this and holding operators accountable for bad customer service, for fraud, for misleading advertising. And these are protections that we often take for granted in first world nations. We were really pleased to have the honor of sitting down and having a conversation with Russell Southwood. Balancing Act is a consultancy that got its start through Russell in the form of a newsletter that's grown to about 9,000 subscribers that covers telecoms, internet, computing, mobile operators, the governments that these operators act in the space of, regulatory agencies, equipment vendors, and other consultants. It's a really interesting read. If you're interested in Africa or other developing countries, and especially technology, and you're not a subscriber, I highly recommend that you do subscribe. It's a free e-letter. It covers broadcast, film, and convergence. So through Balancing Act, the newsletter, he became more involved with consulting for a lot of these organizations that he's talking about. So now when, say, an MTN or a Zain want to extend their brand and reach more users, Balancing Act is an agency that they call upon to sort of do the market research and do the use case studies and really find out about the market. So I'm going to let him explain things for himself. He does it much better than I do. I would like to thank him and Balancing Act for participating in the show. Oh, and before we get into the meat of things, I'd like to thank our first sponsor, the kind people at DrupalCon Paris. Have expressed their enthusiasm for the show, and they want to help us to keep it going. I don't really have any interest in making it my living, just because I'm quite busy with Africa Labs, but I would like to see it become sustainable so we can employ Ugandans who are interested in journalism and who are interested in broadcasting. This is a good testing ground for them. It's sort of invaluable experience for this market. So hopefully we find more sponsors like DrupalCon. So DrupalCon Paris takes place on September 1st through 5th, and it's all about the open source CMS tool Drupal, which is sort of like the big competitor to Movable Type and WordPress. It's an open source conference, and there are scholarships now available at paris2009.drupalcon.org. You can always go to our site, africa.net, and just click on the ad that you'd like to, or click on the ad that you see. Yeah, so thanks to those guys, and hopefully more sponsors follow suit. If you're interested in a spot on the blog or the podcast or a number of our other properties, please email me at j.gosier@africa.org, and I'll get you all set up. So without further ado, I'm going to get into the show. I'd like to thank Balancing Act and Russell Southwood for participating. I'd like to thank Natalie Chimbukwe, who couldn't be here, for making it happen. She's doing some consulting with Balancing Act right now and the UCC. And without further delay, here is the interview with Russell Southwood.
Can you tell us a bit about your organization?
Okay, I run Balancing Act, which was launched about 8 years ago. We do three things. We are a consultancy and research company. That's how we make our living. We publish a series of reports called things like African broadband markets, African voice over IP markets, African voice and data forecasts, and African broadcast and film markets, because we concentrate on three areas, looking only at Africa: telecoms, internet, and broadcasting. And the third thing we do, which is how most people know us, is we run three weekly and fortnightly e-letters, one on telecoms and internet in English, another one in French, and more recently a fortnightly on broadcast and film in Africa.
Okay. Are you thinking of extending that to other languages? Or?
We may add a French edition for the broadcasting letter, but for the moment not. We're updating our website this year, and we've been looking at some of the automatic translation programs, and we were fairly impressed with the results in Portuguese, so we may add that as a feature. The operating languages of technology on the continent tend to be the mainstream business language,
right,
so
right.
You know, too many languages, in a sense, kind of cuts down the number, because appreciate we're a specialist newsletter, which means that the total universe that we reach across all three newsletters is around 10,000. So any subdivision of language is always going to be smaller than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us, I know at least I have received some of your editing on the internet. I don't quite remember how it happened, but they are really interesting, and they talk about a lot of issues on ICT and telecoms in Africa generally. Could you tell us a little bit about how this started, and maybe what your inspiration was, or what your view was, what you were actually thinking about when you started these newsletters?
I had been working in the UK for about 12 years, running my own company with somebody else, working in an almost unrelated area, and had begun to get rather bored with that because it was doing consultancy work and was beginning to sort of see the answers before bothering to ask the questions. So I was looking around for something else to do, and I read an article by John Perry Barlow in Wired magazine about the internet in Africa, which was essentially about how Africa could leap industrialization at some level and create economic development and social development through the use of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of it was kind of crazy sort of American nonsense, and the other half was deeply interesting, deeply inspiring.
Mm.
And so with that mixture, I then began to go and talk to people, and I spent about 6 months talking to people in the UK, and people would say to me as I talked to them, well, there is no internet in Africa, what are you bothering to do this for? Mm. So I went, in fact, on holiday and visited a number of different countries, including Kenya, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. And there was internet, and it wasn't very good, but, you know, hey, it could only get better. And people were doing things with it, and so on and so forth. So I came back and I wrote, I suppose, 1,000 words saying kind of what I did on my holidays, at which point people started to send me stuff. And I got a kind of similar amount of words from somebody in Madagascar about the state of the internet in Madagascar. So I started to put out irregularly to start with, and then on a weekly basis, an e-letter. And it kind of went from there. And I knew that I wanted to be doing specialist data. I knew that I wanted to be doing consultancy. And in a way, the newsletter was a kind of way of introducing myself.
Yeah.
And it involved me in a number of campaigns, I suppose you would describe them as, around cheaper fiber access in all aspects.
Okay.
Have you seen any of like the sort of more recent initiatives? Like there's a website called African Signals, which it just sort of crowdsources, it's a wiki, so people from all these different countries post pricing information about all their providers in their area.
Yeah.
So you can sort of see like the...
What is occurring.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
See what's occurring, see who's charging the most, and you know, see who's sort of
like
way above market and so
No, I haven't seen African Signals. I think it's an excellent development, because I would say that one of the other e-letters that exists is mybroadband.co.za, which is quite South Africa centric, but nonetheless takes the subject from a consumer point of view, whether you're a corporate consumer or whether you're an individual consumer.
Right.
Yeah.
And I would say, as somebody who collects pricing data, one of the great things has been the rise of blogs and people saying on blogs, you know, this is what I'm being charged. You know, I was looking at Rwanda and Rwandan prices the other day, and there's some guy from South Africa saying, you know, this is from Rwanda, saying this is what I get from MTN in Rwanda.
Right.
Mm. Why can't South Africans get the same price?
Right.
So there begins to be a kind of dialogue about what is happening and people becoming more aware of price comparisons and all of that, and that's no bad thing, and particularly around quality issues and quality, just in a way, education at quite a high level, in terms of how people understand exactly how people understand what speed they're getting, how people understand why things go wrong, how they can change them when they go wrong, and what they're paying. So all of that's great.
Very interesting indeed.
Which brings us to maybe the consumer protection issue in Uganda, and the fact that we had the consumer protection workshop, and the fact that consumer protection is being looked at as a more serious issue now, at least in Uganda. What do you think about consumer protection in general in Uganda, and in regard to the research, ongoing research, where do you think this is headed?
Perhaps roll it back a step and explain how I got involved in the consumer research, because I was sitting in England and BT, who was my provider, I needed a new telephone line, and BT tried to split the line. So in other words, I would have two half lines as opposed to a whole line. And I said, no, I wanted two whole lines. That's what I'm paying for, not two half lines.
Right.
And this, at the time, was quite a big issue, and it went all the way up to the chairman's office, and then somebody in the chairman's office said, no, we've got to provide this, local manager, get on with it. And then about a month later, and I don't know why these things happen the way they do, I lost fixed line connection for a month. And deeply, deeply frustrating. But at the end of that month, I was compensated by BT, because there was a service level agreement with consumers that over 48 hours you are compensated for the loss of service, which in a sense incentivizes the provider to get moving and get things fixed. The second thing that happened was I was at a meeting in Kenya quite early on in doing what I do, where ISPs were trying to explain how the wholesale prices had gone down, but why retail prices hadn't gone down. And Edith Adera of IDRC said at that meeting, who speaks for the consumer? And that seemed to me quite an intelligent question. And then very shortly after that, there was a big mobile boycott in Nigeria over prices. So it was those three things coming together made me think, well, we should do something in this area. So we did the first phase of the work, which looked at 30 sub-Saharan African countries. And it was very clear at that stage, almost all of the regulators were tasked with looking after consumers, but had spent most of the first 5 or 10 years of their existence sorting out regulation, sorting out trying to attract investors and things of that kind, and hadn't got round to consumers. This has changed since the point where that study was completed in 2006. You know, the last 3 years, people have set up consumer units, people have set up consumer education and awareness programs, and I guess what we're trying to do with this second phase of the research with IDRC is to get five regulators in different countries, and those countries include Ethiopia, Zambia, Uganda, Mauritius. God, go out of my head what the fifth
Rwanda?
One is. Rwanda. Thank you. You know it better than I do. Because we've had two changes. So those five countries, and with those five countries, to use research to provide evidence to create effective action-based policy. I think the big difference in consumer terms between developed countries, not all developed countries, but those developed countries where consumerism in a sense has taken hold, is that in Africa, this holds true not just for telephony and internet, but pretty much all goods, you're selling shortage, and as a result of selling shortage, prices are high.
Right.
And quite often there are monopolies or limited sources of supply, which means that if you have a complaint, then get stuffed.
Right.
And as a result, there is, you know, kind of not much sense or expectation that anything will be done.
Yeah.
And that's even true for corporate customers.
Right.
Service level agreements in Africa for corporate customers are a relatively recent innovation.
Yeah.
So what one's trying to do with this action plan is to give, in a competitive market, consumers some sense of what their rights are, so mm-hmm. they can say, we are entitled to this, and to set out a framework which will give them some set of entitlements, and to encourage them to make demands of the yep. businesses themselves. Now, this is not anti-business, because I think any intelligent business will say that the intelligence that they get from complaints
uh-huh.
is vital intelligence to how they build their business. Because
yeah.
an unhappy customer is a customer that goes from one operator to another
right.
and is that 10, 20, 30% churn mm. that actually, you know, destroys profitability. So actually getting it right with customers is incredibly important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I've had tons of problems with my internet providers here, and
yeah.
you know, I've switched from one to the other,
yeah.
and I'm thinking of switching again, and you know, that
yeah.
can't be great for MTN.
No,
because we're a business. We, you know,
yeah.
we use
yeah.
a lot of bandwidth.
No, absolutely.
But you know,
but the problems are all over.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way. You know, I switched and had even worse problems. So, what do you do?
Yeah.
But you sort of touched on like complacency in consumers and how.
I'm not sure it's to do with complacency. You will see in Africa groups of people, whether poor people or middle class people, standing in fantastically long queues waiting to do the most basic of transactions, whether that's paying an electricity bill or registering a birth or
yeah.
you know, any of those kinds of things. I'm always fantastically amazed that there's not riots breaking out. Actually, to spend half a day or 3 hours or 2 hours to do the most basic transaction
yeah.
Yeah,
seems
very
to me, you know, kind of a tribute to African patience, but perhaps in a way what one wants is a society that is a bit more demanding. Now, this is
right.
not universally true of Africa.
Yeah.
I would say that it is an oxymoron to say a patient Nigerian or
a
patient Senegalese. So the cultures differ, obviously, but to actually give people some sense that they can make demands on the basis of not receiving service, I think it's quite important to empower the consumers and, in some broader sense, empower individuals to feel that they can make a difference in their lives.
Yeah. I know it's I think it's a very African thing for people to just say, oh, what can I really do?
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you're right when you say that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's
and for years that has been true. But now,
yeah.
you know, in particular services where, you know, there are competitive providers, you can move from one provider to the other. And these services are provided at a level of professionalism that makes it possible to actually deliver what is promised,
right.
yeah.
then the promise should be met.
Right.
Yeah.
And
right.
it's not a case of the president saying all will be well and actually
and
all isn't
everything.
Well.
Right.
Yeah. It's within the bounds of the possible, within
right.
the bounds of deliverable today, yesterday.
Right.
So
right.
that's really what it's about, getting focused on that.
Sure.
One of the big problems that we have here, and we were talking last time about why MTN Mobile Money
yeah.
hasn't really taken off as much as M-Pesa has in Kenya.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were just sort of, you know, brainstorming as
yeah.
to reasons why. And we think the big difference, and I don't know if
yeah.
this is the case or not in Kenya, but
yeah.
here it seems like just the logistics of billing,
yeah.
no one has figured out yet. You know, every month at MTN I have, you know, mystery charges on my bill or, you know, something
yeah.
hasn't been credited.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're going to try to create a system where you're really, you know, taking people's money
yeah.
to distribute it somewhere, you know, that's a huge, you know.
So you're saying it's a trust issue?
Yeah.
Yes, a huge okay. trust issue.
You think it's really more of a trust issue because
okay. Then why did Kenyans trust more quickly? Because after the first 3 months, which were quite slow with M-Pesa, the growth just kind of went skyrocketed.
Really?
Yeah.
Month on month. So
yeah.
A very interesting question is culturally, why is it that Kenyans adopted and adapted
right.
and trusted
right.
more quickly? Because the same is true of Tanzania. I was talking to,
yeah.
to Safaricom about it, and M-Pesa in Tanzania is going much more slowly.
Yeah.
And indeed
yeah.
it is in all the other countries where there are competing services.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of interesting.
That is
like the difference between Nigerians and Senegalese and the rest of the continent. But
right.
you know, it's another cultural difference of some kind.
Yeah.
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 So would it be a culture difference, or it would be for another reason, maybe?
But speak, but Natalie, you speak personally about, you know, why are you not using it?
Well, I don't have reason to do so. I have nobody to send money to as such.
Right.
So, well, I don't really have reason to use it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have, like, maybe, say, dependents to send money to.
Yeah,
but as a contractor, so it'd be nice to get your bills, like, you know, get your invoices paid that way, right?
Maybe I'm just used to the traditional way of doing my things, and I don't think about it so much.
Yeah.
So that's probably the reason. You know, when you get used to doing things in a certain way and you don't really have reason to change.
Yes.
Maybe you're just comfortable where you are.
But do you have a tradition in this country? Because, I mean, what it grew out of in Kenya was people beeping each other units.
Oh, yeah,
people
yeah.
people transacting the units into cash.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, the system was there in an informal sense.
Yeah.
Even before it was launched as a formal service. And so if that exists, then it's very quick. People are very quick to understand, well, I used to do this, and actually somebody's offering me this as a legitimate service, so, you know, what's the difference?
Right.
So, I still don't understand. I still don't
understand. Neither do I.
You'll have to do another study.
I thought I understood it, but now I'm even a little more confused.
Yeah.
So,
but if people are sending each other, have been sending each other units, then I can't see what the trust issue is.
But I'm not so sure that people actually use the unit issues so much. Well, they do.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that it's very popular.
Yeah.
Well, in Uganda.
But do you have people, I mean, you presumably have people, you know, you say you as the son of your, you know, your father will work in the city, he will be back in the village, you will send home money to the family.
Yeah.
That happens a lot.
But then that can be arranged using units. And again,
that
builds a tradition of using this kind of activity.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, Sudan is another place where, because of the American boycott, the banking system doesn't work as, you know, effectively as it might do.
Yeah.
And people again transact, you know, kind of units as cash.
Units as cash, yeah,
you know,
which is easier for
them. They represent cash. They're like, they're like a note in that sense, which is only a piece of paper, which you say is value. Yeah.
Well, I guess Jonathan will need to do some more research on that one.
Switching gears a bit, there. I was curious to know if there's any inefficiencies that you see in consumer protection in developed countries that organization like yours are trying to help the corporations here not recreate, not sort of go down those same mistaken paths.
I'll give another very personal example. I have as my broadband provider a company in the UK called Nildrum, and the broadband line went down, and actually, Nildrum connects at the local exchange of BT, so it doesn't own its own infrastructure, and therefore it's reliant on BT.
Mm-hmm.
However, you can only ring Nildrum, and then Nildrum rings BT, and then BT comes back to you through Nildrum.
Right.
So I had a problem that lasted for 7 days, which might, in African terms, might sound rather trivial, but actually if you're used to having always on broadband and your business is predicated on that, it does begin to kind of become very tiring. Now, when I looked into it, I realized that there was no consumer service level agreement for broadband provision, and BT clearly had persuaded the regulator that this should be the case, because ADSL was seen to be a technology that couldn't deliver consistently particular standards. So I couldn't go and turn and say, actually, look, you know, kind of, this should be repaired in 48 hours, as I could do with my telephone. And my provider, Nildrum, said, a very nice woman who was, you know, quite effective in dealing with the inquiry, said, you should get yourself ready for 3 days, and it may go to 5 or 7. And, you know, I was very, very cross. But I looked at, on the blogs, people had written to Ofcom, and Ofcom had written back saying, you know, there is no protection in this area. Now, my alternatives are wireless or satellite providers. There are almost no wireless providers in urban areas, in London, that are effective. Satellite providers are very expensive, so cable providers possibly, but they don't have a good reputation, and you have to have them in your area. I don't have them in my area. So you can see, you know, there are gaps even within a developed country. It's not by no means perfect. And I think you learn, you simply learn by, you know, kind of discovery. But you were talking about African signals site earlier. I think one of the ways consumers learn is by having sites like that. So if they have a problem, they go on the net, and or they go on the net with someone else's machine if they're having a problem, and they look it up and they say, okay, you know, I'm told it's this, because quite often the explanations are quite technical. You know, we were being told that the DSL line we had in the exchange was being interfered with by another machine, and so they were going to do what was known in the trade as a shift and lift. And this went on, you know, for a considerable period of time. I had no idea what shift and lift was. You know, I'm not at that level of detail. So I discovered, you know, I went on the net and I discovered, you know, what exactly was happening, and I could then be more effective in actually seeking to persuade BT to do the right thing, which was to move the line and to guarantee. And one of the other big problems was that the BT engineers would, and now I'll make this a more general thing, everybody blames everybody else. So it, what would happen is I have a tech guy, initially the tech guy would say it's Nildrum. Nildrum would say it's BT, BT would say it's Nildrum, and then when Nildrum said no, it's not us, they, BT would then say it's you, it's your fault as the customer. So we had a modem, a new modem had been installed, which had been operating for 18 months, and they told us that it was the problem with the modem. And we swapped out the modem three times to convince them that, you know, actually it wasn't the modem. So, you know, those are the frustrations that you can experience within a developed country. So it's not a... This is not something that is... It's not simply an affliction of Africa. This is a more general problem in terms of how these processes work.
Okay. I just had one question that sort of popped up. Is your background, educational background in ICT, in all IT?
I have a slightly unusual background, which I would say is sort of a bit university of life. I was involved in doing one of the first typesetting systems on computers. I was involved in putting a set of newsletters onto an online database long while ago. So that was sort of where I started with this. And started doing that, went away from it, and have in a sense come back to it. And I come slightly from out, I'm not a telecoms person, but I think in many ways that's an advantage. Because you can see the world more clearly because you are not enmeshed
in the telecoms
kind of, particularly engineering. Engineers think in particular ways, which is great for getting networks to work, but it's not necessarily great for delivering service to customers, or indeed thinking about how the market might or might not change over time. They are wont to say, oh, that won't work, or we can't do that, or whatever. Whereas in fact, you know, the changes that have happened in Africa in the last eight years have all, you know, been in the teeth of people saying that will not happen. So, you know, I that's what I think is interesting.
Really interesting, and actually the reason I sort of figured it out without you telling me, because many times in the ICT field, most of the, should I say, the biggest minds or the people who are really active in the ICT field who've been able to make a difference, many of them actually are not from telecoms background or IT background or whatever it is, but what they actually managed to do is really amazing. So I just wanted you to confirm.
I think really it's a twofold thing. I mean, that technology is only interesting in relation to people. It's like, you know, technology is a great big pen. What you write with it's interesting. And it seems to me that building a business out of what people can do is more interesting than building a business that is simply tech-related, because actually, you know, what the customer wants to do, what they are able to do, is particularly important. And you will know in Africa, the ability to use the mobile has absolutely changed lives.
Yeah.
I mean, those days when people would sit around waiting for each other to meet for 3 or 4 hours because, you know, the other person couldn't bring to say they're stuck in traffic the other side of town are long gone.
Right.
And I could give you, you know, dozens of examples. Mm. So I think, you know, all forms of technology, and I think the second wave will be internet.
Yeah.
And what happened with the mobile phone was it reached critical mass, prices came down, and so all of your friends suddenly had a mobile phone, and you would be very left out if you didn't have one.
Right.
The same is not true with internet. Internet is a kind of a rather small club of people who, for whatever reason, have got involved in this. Sometimes they got involved in it because it's an argument about broader changes.
Yeah.
When internet reaches, I don't know, 100,000, 200,000 in a particular country, a million maybe in the larger countries, then people will begin to say to themselves, yes, I will use email.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the same issues are there in developed countries because I can ring somebody and leave a message, I can send them an email, I can send them a text, and quite rational people who are capable of using all three of those technologies will respond to one or more of those messages.
Right.
Some people will not respond to an email. Some people will ignore text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people will only speak on the phone. So you have all those same issues.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of there being a critical mass of people who will want to use email, which is cheaper than SMS.
Yeah.
And in effect, what is SMS? SMS is a kind of rather clunky browser that is almost exactly the same as internet. So when you have systems in place like Mixit and others that allow you to use email on your phone without being aware that you're using email, then slowly that functionality will become much more widespread on mobile phones.
Yeah.
And the number of people using mobile internet is going up.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely convinced that you could make your life on mobile internet, but certainly if you have smartphones, that like iPhone and BlackBerry and so on and so forth, and the numbers of those again below the radar are going up, not into the millions, but into the tens of thousands. All of that builds, you know, the sense that there will be a community of people who will wish to transact their lives, their business, in all forms, using the internet in some way.
That was Russell Southwood from Balancing Act talking about consumer rights and the role it plays in the advancement of IT in Africa and the, sort of the future of technology in Africa in general. I'd like to thank Russell again for participating in the show. Thanks to our sponsor, DrupalCon Paris 2009. Make sure you visit their site. So, we're about 40 minutes in. Let's check out the world in news. So the past couple of days have been ripe with buzz about two big product launches from the two heavyweights in technology, Google and Microsoft. First, Microsoft fired off with Bing, their new search engine, and Google immediately replied with Google Wave, which the only way I can describe it is how they describe it in their PR campaign, which is what email would be like if it was designed today. And by that, what I think they're referring to is the fact that this isn't really so much a product in the sense of, like, it's not like AdSense or like Gmail or anything like that. So it's like an open source web platform that anyone can install on their server. Anyone through what's called federation, all of these different systems would talk to each other. So for instance, to make this very simple for even the most non-techie people to understand. So if you're on Yahoo and I'm on Gmail, just because we're on competing platforms doesn't mean we can't communicate with each other. Different email clients can talk to each other in that way, sort of like different web browsers can talk servers. It doesn't really matter who the product is made by. It's the protocol that makes it possible. So Google Wave is a hugely ambitious project in that it's basically attempting to rethink the way, in many ways, we use the web. I mean, email is a huge portion of everyone's daily activities. And if you can think about for a second, if instead of using your email client every day, you start using some service that's built on Google Wave, and just think of how powerful that is to, and there was some backlash. Omalik wrote, and one of his bloggers wrote some pretty harsh things about Wave, and, as well as some other bloggers. Not everyone's excited about it. The good thing is it's open source, so no one really owns it. Google just sort of has bragging rights. And speaking of Google having bragging rights, people... Well, I'll say this. Bing launched this week with far more praise than I thought it was going to have. I really thought they were just going to rebrand Live Search and then market the heck out of it. But they really have innovated. They've done some interesting things. The problem is, I would say it's like a 0.001 improvement over what Google currently offers. And that's not enough to make this person switch. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm quite happy with what I can do with Google. And the fact that Bing is pulling all this information onto one page. And I played with it for a day. I made it my default for a few hours, I guess. I couldn't quite get into it. Maybe it's just because I'm biased, but I couldn't get into the product. I see how it's way faster than Live Search. It's incredibly fast. And I might even say it's getting as fast as Google. And I'm in Uganda, so I know Microsoft doesn't have any peer servers here, and I think Google does. So it's pretty incredible that they've been able to even get on the same page as Google. When they're so far off the grid from where I am. And I've heard some great things about the speed performance in the States. So it's interesting. It's good to see competition in the search space. I'm all for more competition, you know, to the Mahalos, to the Kules, to the Clusties, the Wolfram Alpha, that thing. You know, more power to them. I hope there's more of them. You know, my money's still on Google until someone figures out a way to take out AdSense. That's really Google's linchpin right now, because they've got the users, they've got, you know, contrary to what Steve Ballmer likes to say, they have way more products than just search that they are dominating and able to monetize. So I think what people, you know, to the would-be Google killers out there, don't worry so much about search. Worry about AdSense. That's what makes Google huge. But at the same time, I'm rooting for Google. And maybe Twitter too. But any more news? Google launched another product just today, actually, called Google Squared, which is all about structured data. And it's funny, when Wolfram Alpha came out, they were calling it a Google killer. Now they're calling Google Squared the Wolfram Alpha killer, which, you know, it's a whole lot of sensationalism. I don't think either product is particularly useful for me. Wolfram Alpha is great for, like, you know, solving math equations or, you know, getting quickly looking up facts. But, you know, it's nothing that I can't do with a combination of Google and Wikipedia and a few grease monkey scripts. So, you know, great, Wolfram, go for it. But just not doing it for me. Also, Google Squared is a bit of a letdown. I wrote about a product last week called Datum.com. That's Datum.com. That was all about crowdsourcing tabular data. I found that far more useful than what Google has done in trying to aggregate its search results and just return them in a tabular structure or a spreadsheet. It just doesn't quite work, and also some of the information that it returns is somewhat questionable. It's good to see more experimentation, but this particular product sort of let me down. Any more tech news? Can't think of anything from the continent right now. So we'll call this one done. Join me next week when Natalie is back and we talk about the latest news in African tech. Until next time, thanks for listening to the show.